Today is Monday, August 23rd, 2010, and this is Stephen Fagan, the Associate Curator at the Sixth Floor Museum at Dealey Plaza. And the interview that we're doing today is part of the museum's ongoing oral history project. And today it's a great honor to be talking to Sonia Pressman Fuentes. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today for this project.
I'm delighted to be able to talk with you.
At the beginning, ma'am, just for the record, I would like to get you to state your full name, your date and place of birth, and just a little brief background about yourself to get us started with the recording.
Well, my full name is Sonia Pressman Fuentes. I was born in Berlin, Germany on May 30th, 1928. I left Berlin with my parents and a brother in about July of 1933 to escape the Holocaust, went first to Antwerp, Belgium, and then at the end of April 1934, we left Antwerp for the United States, and I've been in the United States ever since. I don't know what else you want me to say at this point.
Where did you settle in the U.S.?
A little bit of all over. We initially landed in New York City and moved to the Bronx.
Okay.
And we were there from May 1st, 1934 until sometime in 1936 when we moved to the Catskill Mountains of New York, a little village named Woodridge, New York. And we were in Woodridge for 5 years, and then we moved to a larger nearby town called Monticello, New York, and I graduated from, high school in Monticello, and then went off to Cornell, and subsequently lived in a good many different places.
What prompted your interest in law?
Well, a lot of things. First of all, I had a drive to do something worthwhile with my life, although I had to take that back because at that time I didn't connect that to law. What got me interested in law was that after I graduated from college, from Cornell, I spent 4 years on different jobs as a secretary. Because that's all I could get as a woman and a college graduate when I graduated in 1950, Phi Beta Kappa, but I couldn't really get a decent job until I went to school and studied shorthand. I'd already had typing in high school. So I had these various jobs during 4 years as a secretary, and it was getting me no place fast. So I felt I needed to do something else, and I thought about law because, first of all, I had skills verbally and in writing. My parents in the Catskills had a husband and wife legal team in connection with their investment in mortgages and other business transactions, so I had the role model of a woman lawyer. And then in a great books course, I had read Thomas Aquinas on law, and I liked that. And then in my senior year at Cornell, I was able to take my senior year as the first year in the Graduate School of Business and Public Administration. And one of my teachers, who this past summer turned 94, but at that time, of course, was much younger. His name was Dean David Curtis, and he taught in the law school, but he came over to the School of Business and Public Administration and taught a course in bills and notes. And I thought that was very interesting, and so all of these things combined to get me to thinking about going to law school. But I still didn't know whether to do that or not, because it was a very unusual thing for a woman in 1954 to go to law school. So I happened to be on the train going to Long Beach, Long Island, where I lived at the time, and I saw a young woman there who was a sister of a woman I knew, and this woman that I saw was a lawyer. So I went to sit next to her, and I told her I was thinking about going to law school, and asked her whether I should go. And she encouraged me to do so. If she hadn't, I don't know what I would have done. And the other thing that happened was I used to spend the winters after graduation from college. I spent the winters with my parents in Miami Beach. And one time I was driving in Coral Gables past the University of Miami. And whenever I've seen a college or a university, I would like to matriculate there. So I said to myself, oh, this looks beautiful. Well, I'd like to go here. But I said to myself, but I've already graduated from college. I can't go again. So then I said, oh, but I could go if I went to the law school. So I took the law placement exam and came out in the 98th or 99th percentile. So that was another reason impelling me to go.
Mm-hmm.
And then the final reason was, just before I went, I decided 4 days before my birthday to have a birthday party. And I called several friends and invited them to come to my party. And my birthday happens to fall on Memorial Day or Decoration Day. And everybody already had plans, so nobody could come to my party. So I said, this is no good. I was relying on my friends and my boyfriend, and none of them can come to my party. I better do something else and stand on my own 2 feet. So all of those things.
Very interesting. I think I mentioned to you in our early correspondence that this project that we do at the museum explores the history and culture of the years 55 to 75, a time of great social change and activism, and of course you were a big part of that. I read a little bit about you, and I found a speech you gave at Cornell in the year 2000, which was of particular interest, and in it you say that you feel that the start of the sexual revolution in the United States began in December of 61, and you cite that because of President Kennedy's establishment of the Commission on the Status of Women.
Right.
I'd like to start there. Could you talk a little bit about that and whether or not that was inspirational to you at the time?
It was not inspirational to me at the time. I didn't know about it at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I learned about it when I started to learn about women's rights. So I can't say it had any effect on me. I just did research and learned about it. I got involved in women's rights in 1963.
Okay.
It was my first involvement.
So
not
at,
before then.
So at that time, in 61, when this happened, even though it was a seminal moment later on, it wasn't something that was publicized very much, that you were aware of it?
Well, I was. First of all, there was no such thing as women's rights at that time,
mm-hmm.
basically. And I wasn't involved in women's rights at that time. And I didn't know about it. And my guess would be, I don't like to say things that I don't know about, but my guess would be that most people didn't know this was going on at the time.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me what particular memories you have, if any, of President Kennedy and his time in the White House?
Not a lot. I was working, I think, when he first came. What year did he first come into the White House?
He was elected in 1960, and he took office January of 1961.
All right. It was about that time that I went to work in the, I was working for the National Labor Relations Board in Washington, D.C. And about that time, I wanted to go out west, and I got a detail to the NLRB's Los Angeles office. But I remember before that thinking the NLRB's office was on something like 17th and Pennsylvania Avenue. And I used to think, he's only a block away. Why can't he walk over, President Kennedy, and say hello to us at the NLRB? But he never did. So I don't have too much recollection other than what everybody read in the papers and that it was Camelot and Jackie and that kind of thing. I mean, I know what everybody else knew who reads.
Did you buy into that, the ideal of Camelot with the young couple in the White House?
I did. I think I did. First of all, I'm a lifelong liberal Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
So I was happy because I viewed President Kennedy as a liberal Democrat. So I was happy about his being. Which president did he follow?
Dwight Eisenhower, who was the oldest in history up to that time.
For what?
Eisenhower was the oldest president in history up to that time period, so Kennedy was young in stark contrast to that, and I wanted to ask you about that as well.
The age wasn't the thing with me.
Mm-hmm.
The thing with me was that I didn't particularly care for Eisenhower. He was a Republican. Didn't strike me as particularly bright, whereas Kennedy did. So it was a difference to me between Eisenhower as a Republican who wasn't particularly bright or witty as compared to JFK, who I viewed as a liberal Democrat, who was bright and witty.
Mm-hmm. And what did you think of Jackie and her influence on fashion and culture at the time?
I wasn't crazy about her. Let me give her this. She was beautiful and dressed beautifully. But I'm not that kind of person.
Mm-hmm.
I'm somebody who's interested in substance and in making the world a better place in which to live. I admire professional women, women who achieve in their fields. So while I thought Jackie was beautiful and certainly was a gorgeous first lady and made a wonderful impression when she traveled abroad, she wasn't the kind of woman that I particularly admire.
I see. Much has been written and revealed about Kennedy's personal life and alleged indiscretions in the years since the assassination. I'm curious, as someone who's, you know, a pioneering feminist, what do you think about Kennedy today as opposed to what his image was during his time in office in the 60s?
Well, a lot different. First of all, I don't like men who cheat, whether they're presidents or just average men.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing to me the extent to which he did cheat and got away with it, because in those days the reporters didn't report it like they have since Gary Hart. Also, I have read in what poor health he was, and did not share that, perhaps understandably, with the American public. And I read that if Oswald hadn't killed him, he didn't have that much longer to live anyway, which is amazing for a man so young. As far as his administration, I remember the Bay of Pigs. I remember the Cuban Missile. The Cuban Missile crisis had a real emotional effect on me. But beyond that, I feel that he wasn't president long enough to have really made a mark.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me where you were on the day of the assassination, November 22nd of 63?
I can, because it's an interesting story. As I mentioned, I was working for the National Labor Relations Board in Los Angeles, and the director of that office was a man named Ralph Kennedy. I found him a very unpleasant man. He was a dirty old man. I just didn't like him at all. So I was in the hall of the office one day, and I hear people start to shout, "Kennedy's been shot." Now, I don't usually like to hear that anybody's been shot, but I must say, when I heard that, I thought it was Ralph Kennedy, the regional director. And I thought it couldn't happen to a more deserving guy. And imagine my surprise and dismay when I learned that it was the president. It was a terrible thing. Terrible thing.
Did it have an emotional impact on you?
Absolutely. And that whole business with their being in Dallas, and she was in the car, and the blood splattered on her, and I think it was Connolly was there. I think he was also shot, and his wife, and the whole thing was horrible.
Did you have, or did anyone around you have any sort of frustration or negative reaction to the city of Dallas because it happened here?
I had a bad experience in Dallas one time, but I don't recall whether it was before, it was probably after what happened to Kennedy.
Okay.
Would you repeat that question again?
My question was, in the aftermath of the assassination, did you or anyone that you knew and talked with have a negative reaction to Dallas because the assassination took place here?
No, I wouldn't say a negative reaction. I would say that is associated with Dallas, that tragedy. But I wouldn't say I have a negative reaction to Dallas, but that is associated with Dallas.
On our on the sixth floor of the former book depository where we have our museum, we have a variety of books and music and movie posters from the time period. And one of the ones that's featured is the Feminine Mystique by Betty Friedan. And I wanted to ask you about that and if you read the book in 63 when it was published and what kind of an impact it had on you.
I remember being very favorably impressed with it. It was also very repetitious. She basically had one idea there, and she kept giving different examples and repeating it, but the idea she had was a good one. I was favorably impressed with it.
You mentioned earlier that 1963 was the year you really became interested in women's rights. Can you talk a little bit about how that happened?
No, it was the year that I first did something in women's rights.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit about how that happened?
Yes. It's interesting because it was separate from what happened later on and a sort of a foreshadowing of it, but who knew? I was working at the National Labor Relations Board, and I was friendly with a guy there named Leo Weiss, who was a lawyer as I was. So one day I walked into his office, and I saw on his desk something from the ACLU. So I said to him, what is that? And we got to talking about it, and he said, he volunteers for the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union. And I said, gee, you know, that might be an interesting thing for me to do. So he encouraged me to do that. So I volunteered, and the director of the ACLU in Washington, D.C. was a guy named Larry Spicer. So after I volunteered with him, he asked me to draft some testimony for him to give in favor of the equal pay bill, which was in the Congress. I knew nothing about it, but I began to educate myself and find out about it and work on the speech, and then somewhere along the line, he suggested that I deliver it. So I was 34 years old at the time, and I gave this testimony in favor of the equal pay bill before this House committee. And I thought that was the beginning and end of any involvement of mine having to do with a women's rights issue. And shortly after that is when I left for Los Angeles to work at the NLRB's Los Angeles office. So that's how that happened.
Looking back, this was in 1963, of course, looking back now, through the prism, I guess, of your activism, you mentioned in that speech at Cornell that, you know, that things really started, the revolution began in December of 61. Do you feel that during his brief time in office, Kennedy really did anything to contribute to the what eventually became the women's rights movements, or do you feel that he was slow to action?
I don't feel, there was nothing going on at that time, but he did appoint that Women's Committee. I don't have my remarks in front of me. He did do that, but I don't know anything about it, and I have never really thought about that beyond what happened in 61.
Was President Kennedy and his words in any of his speeches, was that in any way influential to you during your period when you were very active with the women's movement?
Not that I can recall, although I thought he was an eloquent and moving speaker. I particularly liked when he said, Ich bin ein Berliner, when he spoke in Berlin, partially because he know German, but it was also a nice thing to say. But no, not that I can recall.
Okay. The Civil Rights Act of 64, which, of course, Johnson pushed through Congress after President Kennedy's death, many female, many feminists lobbied that bill because sexual discrimination would be illegal. Can you speak to that at all? Were you involved or had any thoughts at the time about that?
It isn't true what you just said.
Okay. Please correct me.
The only one I really know who worked for it was the Reverend Dr. Paulie Murray, who wasn't a reverend at that time. Let me give you a little background.
Okay.
That Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was essentially a bill that was a result of the civil rights movement for rights for blacks and African Americans.
Mm-hmm.
It also included religion, national origin, color, and so on, but it was mostly for blacks. And towards the latter part of the legislative debate on this bill, Congressman Howard Smith from Virginia introduced an amendment to include a prohibition against gender discrimination. His motives for doing so are not clear. He was an opponent of the bill altogether and ended up voting against it, as did many of his Southern cohorts. So one possible motive that he might have had, and undoubtedly had, was to delay the bill or kill it altogether
mm-hmm.
by introducing this sex discrimination prohibition. But he also had a close relationship with Alice Paul, who founded the National Woman's Party, and she wanted sex discrimination prohibited in that bill. So he may have done that at her request or agreeing with her. He clearly didn't want black men getting rights at the expense of white women, or black and men and women getting rights at the expense of white women. So all of these things may have been in his mind
mm-hmm.
when he introduced the amendment to prohibit sex discrimination. Now, Congresswoman Martha Griffiths once told me, and I think this was when we had the 20th reunion of the founding of NOW, she told me that if the Congressman Howard Smith hadn't introduced the sex discrimination prohibition, she was prepared to do it. Now, she was straight up and down a feminist, and there would have been no question about her motivations. But she didn't do it because he did do it. So then after he did it, the other members of Congress were by and large not crazy about the idea, but who was going to get up and say, we don't think this act should prohibit sex discrimination when it was going to prohibit discrimination based on race, color, religion, and
right.
national origin? Who's going to get up and say that? So nobody did. It was, or not many did, whatever. So meanwhile, it was towards the end of the legislative debate, and there was not a lot of debate on this. There was some discussion, but there was not a lot. So then the act passed with this in it. And because of these unusual circumstances, also there hadn't been a women's movement preceding the enactment of this law, as there had been a movement for African Americans. So when the law became law, nobody knew how to interpret it and what it meant and what women were. Oh, and I forgot to say, there were two women who fought against the inclusion of the sex discrimination prohibitions in the act. One was Esther Peterson, who I think was Secretary of the Department of Labor at that time, and the other one was her buddy, Elizabeth Koontz. No, not Elizabeth Koontz. Got the wrong name. I'll think of it in a minute. Elizabeth Koontz was a wonderful director of the Women's Bureau. Evelyn Kaiserling. I think her first name was Evelyn Kaiserling. I may have a first. Mary Kaiserling. That's it. Mary Kaiserling, who was head of the Women's Bureau in the Department of Labor, and Esther Peterson. They didn't want sex added to Title VII because they both came out of the labor movement, especially Esther Peterson. I don't know that Mary Kaiserling came out of the women's movement, but they came out of the labor movement. And they had fought for protective legislation for women. And they said that they wanted a special statute to prohibit sex discrimination. They didn't want it to be part of Title VII. But they were not successful.
That's very interesting. I'm glad you were able to give us that background.
Now, I had to laugh at one point when you wrote me that some of your oral interviews lasted 9 minutes. Because I told you ours
would
not.
Oh, no, I understand. I understand. Yeah, everyone has, you know, different memories of that time period, and you were someone who was certainly very, very active, and so you do have quite a story to tell. I would, of course, like to talk with you about the founding of NOW and your involvement of that, and I'd like to get sort of that story through your personal perspective. Would you mind sharing that with me?
Not at all.
Great.
Well, there's a backstory. I don't know if you wanted to how I came to the EOC.
I would love to hear that if you wouldn't mind sharing it.
All right. So I was working at the, well, I first came to what, well, the, did you read my book at all? Have you had a chance to a lot of this?
It is actually on order. It has not arrived, but I was able to do some background research on you online and through some other publications.
Okay. I don't know how far to go back on this. It really started with my being in law school.
Okay.
I'll start with that. So I'm in law school, and my goal in going to law school was to be in private practice. But in the summers, in one summer before I graduated, I worked for a private law firm, a small private law firm in Miami Beach. And it did not inspire me with whatever. I did not find it a very inspiring place. And a lot of things about it I didn't care for, so it created a question in my mind. But I still had it in my mind because, as I mentioned, my parents had this husband and wife legal team. So I think my idea was to marry a lawyer and to practice law with him. So here I am. I'm a senior in law school, and a law professor calls me one day, a woman law professor who was also the head of the law library at the University of Miami Law School. Her name was Minette Massey. I had never taken a course with her, just so happened, but she knew who I was. So she calls me one day and she says, "Sonia, did you see there's a notice up on the bulletin board that recruiters are coming here from the United States Department of Labor to recruit lawyers?" So I said, "Yeah, I saw that notice, but I have no interest in going to work in Washington," so I didn't respond. The backstory on that is that when I used to drive to Miami Beach with my parents, we always passed through Washington, D.C., and it looked like a big building with all these great buildings and with all these anonymous people working in them, and I didn't want to work in such a big building and such a big place and nobody would know who you are. So that's why I said to Minette, I had no interest in working for the federal government or in being in Washington. So she says to me, "Well, I think you should go to the interview, and I made an appointment for you at 2:00 on Friday." Now that might have been, while we were talking, could have been Wednesday or Thursday. So what could I do? She had already made the appointment for me. So I said, okay. So I went to that appointment. And subsequently, this woman, Bessie Margolin, whom I got to know later on, she was a feminist. She had some big position in the Department of Labor. She offered me a job. And I took it. Then other recruiters came from the U.S. Department of Justice. So by this time, I went again. And they also offered me a job. And they had something called the Attorney General's Program for Honor Law Graduates. So they offered me a job, and I was impressed with this Attorney General's Program for Honor Law Graduates. So I took that job, And then I wrote to Bessie Marvel and then said, I'm taking the job with Justice. I won't be taking the job with you. And she said, fine. So I went up to Washington in, you know, like September of 1957 after I took the Florida bar, intending to stay in Washington 3 or 6 months and then look for that job in private practice. That had always been my goal. So I opted to work for the Office of Alien Property, which was a division within the Department of Justice, because it dealt with property that had been seized during different wars and from people who had property in the United States but were foreign nationals, and then some of those people were entitled to get their money back, their property back. So because of my foreign background, I thought this would be an interesting thing for me to do. So I began to work there, and I worked there about a year and a half when they had a meeting, and they announced that we would all have to find different jobs because the Office of Alien Property was going to be moved from being an independent agency to being a section or a division of the Justice Department. And then it would be phased out altogether. But they said they would guarantee each of us in this honor program that they would get us a job. So I was standing next or sitting next to some guy who says to me, they can't do that. I said, what do you mean? He says, they can't guarantee you a job, that they'll find you another job. I said, what's the matter with you? This is a federal official. He's telling me he's going to get me another job. Of course he will. So then they told us we would all have jobs in U.S. attorney's offices. So I went to New York City, and I had a whole day of interviews with the U.S. attorney's office in New York City. And then they asked me to come back the next day because the big mucky muck was out that day, but he would see me the next day. So I went back the next day, and I'm walking into this guy's office, and he looks at me, and he says, I thought you would be older than you are. So I said to him, how could I be older than I am? So I didn't get that job. So then I came back, and I saw that that guy who told me they weren't going to get me a job was right. So another man at the NLRB named Paul Elkins was also looking for a job. No, this was the guy, wait a minute. Oh, this was the guy at the Office of Alien Property, Paul Elkind, who also had to find a job, and I knew that he'd found a job at the NLRB. So I called him up. I said, Paul, you've just been looking for a job, and you got one at the NLRB. Where should I go to look for a job? So he said, why don't you come here? There are jobs at the NLRB. So I said, okay, and he set me up for an interview with a guy named Lou Schwartz. Are you still there, Stephen?
Yes, ma'am. I'm enjoying this.
So he set me up for an interview with this guy named Lou Schwartz. So I come into the office, and this Lou Schwartz says to me, you're applying here for a job with the NLRB. He says, you are interested in labor law. I said, no, never occurred to me. He says, you studied labor law in college. I said, no. He says, you took labor law in law school. I said, no. He said, if you get this job, you plan to take courses in labor law. I said, I never thought of it. He said, why are you here? I said, I need a job. He said, you're hired. So that's how I began to work at the National Labor Relations Board. The odd thing is that I was in the section called advice and some other words, and the job of this section was to tell labor lawyers in offices of the NLRB around the country how to handle difficult legal questions that they didn't know how to handle. What's funny about that is that I knew absolutely nothing about labor law. And here I was in this position of advising people who did how to handle difficult things. So somehow I was there from, I went there in, By this time, I would have been 1959. And I worked in different sections there and so on. But I was always, all my life, looking for a more challenging job. And the reasons for that were that, first of all, my mother planned to have an abortion with me, but the doctor was out. So my life was saved at that time. It was saved a second time when I escaped with my family from Germany. And then I knew I was bright. So I put all that together, and from the age of 10, I had this feeling that there was something I was supposed to do in the world. I didn't know what it was. I couldn't tell it to anybody because they would have thought I was crazy. But I had that feeling. So whatever job I had, I was always looking for that other job where I'd be doing that for which my life had been saved. So I went to the NLRB's office in Pittsburgh, I went to the NLRB's office in Los Angeles, I came back to Washington, and I was always looking for another job. So I knew this guy, Art Christopher, who was an African-American man, and he liked women. So he used to always have, often have lunch with me and holding out the carrot that he knew a lot of people and could get me another job. But we had lunch, but he never came up with any job for me. So one day I was talking to my friend Jackie Williams, who was also African-American, as our Christopher was, and she was also a lawyer at the Labor Board, and she said, how are you? And I said, I'm fine, but I said, I just had another one of these useless lunches with Art Christopher. He's always promising me another job, and it never happens. So Jackie said, oh, if you want another job, why don't you go over to the EEOC? My former professor at the Howard Law School, Charlie Duncan, is the new general counsel, and he's looking for people. So I called up this Charlie Duncan, and I made an appointment. And I went to see him, and I'm walking in his office, and his desk is full of papers. So he says to me, do you see these papers? I said, yes. He says, those are all applications for the one job I have in the general counsel's office. And then he looks at me and he says, I don't know why, but I'm going to hire you. So that's how I came to the EEOC to enforce a brand new law that prohibited job discrimination based on race, color, religion, sex, and national origin. So once I was there, I got very interested, because I'm a woman, I got very interested in the women's rights part. And I became an expert in that part. It was easy to be an expert because it was a brand new law. Nobody knew nothing.
Right.
So, but I found it very frustrating the first year, a year and a half, because the commission wasn't doing anything about women's rights. They weren't doing anything for two reasons. One, there were 100 people at the agency in the beginning, and they mostly had come there to do something for blacks. So they didn't want the commission's time and resources diverted to issues of sex discrimination. And the second reason was that the prohibition against sex discrimination raised a host of legal questions of interpretation that nobody knew how to resolve. Because as I said to you earlier, there hadn't been a women's movement preceding Title VII. There was a women's movement that got the vote, but that was in 1920. So there was no women's movement to flesh out how this law should be interpreted. So nobody was doing anything about women's rights. So I was very frustrated because of that. And it was at that point that Betty Friedan came into the office.
And you knew her because of her, her writing?
No, I didn't know her.
Okay.
I knew she wrote The Feminine Mystique, but that's all.
Okay. Up until now, did you feel like you were sort of on your own? Did you feel sort of lonely in your pursuit?
I wasn't yet in a pursuit.
Okay.
the time I really felt lonely was, well, we'll talk more, but I really felt lonely when I went to work for TRW.
Okay.
For different, for related, but different reasons. I don't know that I felt, well, I did somewhat, that's right, because there's a part of my book where there was this executive director of the EOC, and his name was Herman Adelsberg. And he was not for women's rights. And another guy who wasn't for it was a guy named Dick Berg, who was the deputy general counsel in my office. It hurt me that both these guys were Jewish.
Mm.
And they were not for women's rights. So one time I had this discussion with this Herman Adelsberg. I don't remember what the issue was. It was women's rights. And I left his office, and I was walking to the metro, wherever I was walking, and tears were running down my face because I didn't know how did I get into this position that I'm arguing with a guy like Herman Adelsberg. He's the executive director of the agency. I've got no title. I'm just a lawyer, a staffer in the office of the general counsel. I've got no clout. I've got no power. I've got no nothing. And here I am arguing with this guy, and I have no leverage. And also, nobody elected me to do this. You know, nobody said, you represent women here, go fight for women. I didn't know how I got into this position.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't lonely that I felt. I felt frustrated and in a spot.
So Betty Friedan comes in the office. Do the two of you get along well immediately?
No. She comes in the office to interview my boss, the general counsel, and his deputy. She thought she was going to write a second book. So this would have been 1965, 66. She thought she was going to write a second book about the progress that women had made since she published The Feminine Mystique. Now, after she found out what was going on, that isn't the book she wrote. But that's why she came there. So she saw me there, a woman in the office. I was the first woman, and at that time the only woman in the office of the general counsel, so she saw me. So she came over to me, and she said, what's going on here? What are the conflicts? What are the problems? So I'm looking at this woman. I don't know her. She doesn't know me. I'm working for the government. I'm going to tell her what the problems are. I'm going to lose my job. So I said to her, everything's fine here. So she went on, but she came back a couple of weeks later. And it was at a time that I had had it up to here with frustration. So I invited her into my office. And I told her what was going on, that they weren't doing anything for women. And I said, what this country needs is an organization to fight for women like the NAACP fights for Negroes. In those days, I would have said Negroes. Today, I would say blacks or African Americans.
Mm-hmm.
So I said that to her. And then some time later, at a meeting of the commissions on the status of women, now started to be formed.
And how many people would you credit being there at the inception of now? Yourself and Betty Friedan, obviously.
It gets a little complicated, but you happen to be talking to the one person in this country who can answer that question.
Okay, well, I'm glad I'm asking you then.
Because in December of 2009 and in January of this year, I decided to do research on the founders of now because I saw they were dying, and also people were throwing different numbers around. So now was founded first at this meeting of the Commissions on the Status of Women, which took place in June of 1966, where I was not present. And secondly, there was an organizing meeting in Halloween weekend of October 1966, where I was present. And my research reveals that there were 49 male and female founders of NOW. I was able to get up-to-date information on 42 of those 49. And of those 42, I found 9 are alive today.
Wow. And what would you say would be your personal contribution to this organization. What unique quality did you bring?
Well, I wouldn't put it that way. First of all, I gave Betty Friedan the idea. Mm-hmm. Now, other people have said they also gave her that idea. But in her book, It Changed My Life, and in an article she wrote in the New York Times Magazine section in 1973, she credits me with giving her that idea.
Mm-hmm.
So number one, I gave her that idea. Number two, well, beyond that, I was, I don't remember this, but some other women told me that I played a significant role in that October 1966 meeting where we drafted a statement of position or a statement of principles and skeletal bylaws. And there were these, there was this nun who was a founder, Sister Mary Jo Reed, and she was there with this other woman whom I know, can't think of her name at the moment. And they once made a video, and they seem to remember that I played a significant role at that meeting. I don't know that I did. Another thing that I did was, after NOW was founded, what I did was, and I don't know that this was a terribly significant thing, but just something that I did. I used to meet at night with colleagues, Mary Eastwood and Phineas Indrids, colleagues from the women's movement, and a woman named Carruthers Berger, and I would tell them what the EOC was doing for women and what they weren't doing that they should be doing and that kind of thing, and then we'd sit down and draft letters to the EOC from NOW, and we'd say, how come you made this decision and it isn't good for women, or how come you didn't make this decision and it's good for women, and we'd send those letters to the EOC. And I always say it's amazing to me, nobody at the EOC ever said, how come NOW knows what we're doing? And nobody ever suspected me, you know, of that. And another thing I did was I wrote one of the early digests of legal interpretations. I wrote the guidelines on pregnancy and childbirth. I wrote the first decision involving airline stewardesses. And I was the person at the commission who wasn't at a high level, who was constantly pushing for women's rights. There were some other women there. Van Swift was one, and she was assistant to Vice Chairman Luther Holcomb. She was interested in women's rights, but she was not interested in being thought of as a women's rights person. So she was not out front about it. I was.
I want to go back to what you said a moment ago. You were talking about what I've heard you describe in interviews as your underground activity, meeting at night.
That was just those meetings.
This was something that could have cost you your job if you had been caught?
Absolutely.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit about your mindset, about what prompted you to sort of put your career on the line to participate in these activities that you believed in?
I once suggested to my NOW colleagues, one of the things that was part of our society at that time was the newspaper's classified advertising columns were sex segregated. There were columns headed Help Wanted Male and Help Wanted Female. And in the ads also, people would say, I'm looking for a woman to be my secretary, I'm looking for a man to be an engineer. So two things. The columns were sex segregated, and the ads indicated a preference for sex. So one of the things we at the commission were dealing with in the early days was how to handle that. And the newspapers liked it because it gave them double revenue. Instead of running one set of classified ads, they had two. So I'm a very nonviolent person. I don't use physical violence in any way. But I suggested once to my colleagues at NOW that we should go into the Washington Post building in Washington, D.C., and destroy the presses. And everybody looked at me. Nobody paid any attention to that, fortunately. But that's an indication to you of how emotionally caught up I was in this issue.
Right.
And how frustrated I was that the commission wasn't doing what I thought needed to be done about it.
I wonder
so that explains to you.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, I come out of a middle-class background. I was never poor. My father was always financially able to support me, didn't want me to go to work in the first place. So had I lost my job, it wouldn't have been the end of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And in those days, you could always get another job. But to tell you the truth, I didn't think about it.
Mm.
I was so caught up in the issue that I just never gave it a thought. But when I look back on it with hindsight, what amazes me is not that I did it, but that nobody at the OC said, how does now know what we're ruling on?
Yeah. I want to ask you about the context of the time period, because, of course, the Vietnam War was going on. The NAACP and other civil rights organizations were very active. The gay rights movement was starting. This was a time in the mid to late 60s of activity and activism. Did you feel part of something larger than just the women's rights movement? Can you kind of characterize the era for me?
No. I was totally involved.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't like the students and the others who were involved in the Vietnam War.
Okay.
Looking back on it now, they were right. But I didn't know that at the time. All I knew was that I wanted to drive to work, and people were blocking the car, and I couldn't drive to my office.
Okay.
And so it was an annoyance to me. Mm-hmm. And I was still at the stage of my life where I thought the government must be right. The government must know what it's doing.
Mm-hmm.
The government is always looking out for us. So I figured if the government is at war in Vietnam, they must know what they're doing. I'm way past that kind of naive thinking, but at that time, that's how I thought. So these Vietnam protesters were simply an annoyance to me.
Okay.
To me, the women's movement was the big issue that I was involved in.
Okay.
I also was very involved in rights for African Americans,
mm-hmm.
but not as involved emotionally I was, but not as involved activity-wise, but I was a life member of the NAACP and was always very interested in that.
Mm-hmm. Here in 2010, you know, 45, almost 50 years detached from this experience, are you disappointed that... Do you feel that young people don't appreciate the struggles you went through in the 60s and in the creation of now and your activism at the time? Do you feel like there's not a large enough awareness of what you did?
No. I never think about that.
Okay.
People ask me that all the time. I am so happy to have seen the incredible results that we achieved way beyond anything we could have envisioned. And that the world has changed, and that it's better for young women today.
Mm-hmm.
And besides, I get a great deal of recognition.
Yes.
So I do not feel that way. And I do a lot of, I'm constantly writing and speaking and educating people about what happened. All day today, I've spent writing an article about the Supreme Court, not an article, a speech,
mm-hmm.
about the Supreme Court that I'm giving at New College here. On the 1st of September, and a lot of it will have to do with the women on the Supreme Court and that kind of thing. But so I'm always involved in educating the public as to what happened, but I don't have this feeling that they don't appreciate it and this and that.
Mm-hmm.
The goal was to make life better for women.
And you feel that you were successful in that?
Well, not... Let me tell you if you use the word successful, we have accomplished a lot, but huge problems remain. I have a speech that's on the internet that I gave at Cornell
mm-hmm.
last April, and that would be a good one for you to look at.
Okay.
There are still huge problems in the United States and in the world for women. So I don't want you to think that I feel we've solved all the problems for women,
mm-hmm.
but we have made a tremendous difference. We're on our way. We're not what we used to be and all that kind of stuff. But we have a long way to go, and also for women around the world.
I want to give my intern, Kristen McCaffrey from the University of North Texas, the chance to ask you a few questions. She has a few specific questions about now I think she wants to ask you. So I'm going to turn it over to her, and then I'll come back at the conclusion.
Okay.
All right, here she is.
Hi.
Hi, Kristen.
I have a question. In 1970, NOW began its campaign for the Equal Rights Amendment to become law. How did NOW get the word across?
Well, first of all, I don't know about this 1970. NOW isn't the biggie with regard to the ERA. There are other organizations that have been fighting for the ERA, and it started with Alice Paul, who drafted the ERA, and whom I knew, and I'd have to look up when that started, but that started way before 1970. I think it started in 1920, as a matter of fact. When we got suffrage, Alice Paul, I think shortly thereafter, drafted the Equal Rights Amendment. So while NOW supports it, it's not the the National Woman's Party, which I was a board member, was really carrying the water on that one for a long time. They aren't anymore. But it didn't start in 1970, and NOW wasn't the biggie.
So,
what was your question?
So you weren't involved in campaigning for the ERA?
I was. I've always supported the ERA, but that wasn't my main focus because I feel that the ERA would really be largely symbolic. It's an important thing because women feel that unless they're given rights in the Constitution, the rights they've gained by statute, they can lose, and it would also play a role in certain areas, but my focus has really been Title VII. I certainly support the ERA. I'm disappointed that the President Obama hasn't done more to push the ERA, but he's got a lot of other things on his plate. So I've always felt that until we get a president who will use his bully pulpit to push for the ERA, we're not going to get it. And to my regret so far, Obama, who I thought would do it, isn't doing it.
Okay. How did the NAACP influence the women's movement?
My guess would be that the women saw what the African Americans did to fight for their rights and also felt that they would fight for their rights. And I think women also were involved. I know women were involved in the civil rights movement and were sometimes given subordinate positions. Well, no, that was really with suffrage. That was really with the abolition movement and suffrage. Basically, I think it's that they saw African Americans achieving their rights and decided to fight for their rights also. But there were a lot of other factors besides other than the NAACP that created the women's rights movement.
Okay. Thank you so much for your time. I'm going to turn the phone over to Stephen.
Okay.
All right, ma'am. At the conclusion of these oral histories, I always leave it open. You know, we're specifically focused on the years 55 to 75 with a specific interest in the Kennedy years and the impact of the assassination. Is there anything else you can think about that we haven't touched on today about the history and culture of that time period that you'd like to share with us for the museum's archives?
Not that I can think of offhand.
Okay. Well, I do appreciate you taking the time to talk to us and contribute your story to our ongoing oral history project. And as promised, I'll be sending you an MP3 file of this for your website and a CD as well in the mail.
Terrific. And it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you so much, ma'am. You have a great day.
You too.
All right. Bye-bye.